Welcome back, everyone, to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. It's a great pleasure to have Ken Ng with us today. Ken is a finishing PhD student at MIT, and we'll talk about the search for ultralight bosons and primordial black holes. Ken, please take it away.
Okay, so first of all, thanks for inviting me to give a talk at Perimeter Institute. As mentioned, I will be talking about the search for ultralight bosons and primordial black holes. In particular, I will use the measurements from the binary black holes gravitational wave emissions to perform such searches. And I will talk about some present constraints and also some of the future forecasts of what we can achieve in terms of the precision. So these are so I highlighted some of our papers contributing the results. So if you want to know more about my work, you can take a look at on those papers. So I guess so we'll first start with why we are interested in using gravitational wave as a unique probe of these particles and or like primordial objects. So first of all, ultralight bosons, I guess many of you will probably know because this is one of the pioneering work from Binder, and also Will is, I think, who is also in the audience, is that we can use a phenomena called superradiance to detect them through gravitational wave emission or and also the black hole spin measurements. So this is purely gravitational effect and does not rely on any unknown coupling with other standard model particles. And we can use this phenomena to probe a much lighter mass range of the boson, which is usually unachievable by the usual particle experiments. And then for primordial black hole, of course, they are black holes, right? So when we have a pair of them, then they can form a binary. And then when we have binary, we can directly detect them through gravitational wave. And then we can measure their mass spectrum and spin spectrum. And then we can also trace their formation history by measuring their distance or equivalent to redshift. So the outline of this talk is the following. So in the first half, I will talk about the constraints on the ultralight bosons using the spin measurements. In particular, we are using the superradiance spin down effect. So as I will talk about that later, so superradiance will usually lead to two major effects. One is the spin down for a black hole, and another is the continuous wave, which is another direction that many people have been involved in, but for my study, I just used the spin down effect. And from that, we used the second catalog released by LIGO, Vehicle, and Cargo collaboration. And we made use of all the binary black hole mass and spin measurements to give some new constraints or at least complementary to current searches. So I will forecast a little bit about how we can improve our constraints in the coming decades. I probably won't have time for more futuristic search using multi-band methods. So that is, we have a laser and also we have ground-based detectors. But yeah, if you are interested, you can ask in Q&A at the very end. And also, I guess I forgot to mention, so feel free to interrupt when you have questions. Yeah. And then the second half, we'll talk about some of the complications when we interpret current data to constrain the primordial black holes fraction and how the next generation detectors can provide much cleaner evidence for their existence. And okay, so I guess let's start with the overview of boson superradiance. The superradiance work is really, I guess most of you will be familiar with, because Mina and also Will have been like looking for the theoretical and also the numerical framework for in a quite a detail, but let me just give a very broad overview again. So ultralight bosons are really any bosons with a very light mass. So they are like 10 to minus 30 eV or up to 10 to minus 5 eV. So it's not a very strict bound, but it's in terms of order magnitude, it can span quite a large range. So the possible particles in this category can be like the very original one, which we read QCD axion that solves the strong CT problem. And they can also be so-called axion-like particle that can explain, that can be like alternative dark matter candidate, or we usually call it fuzzy dark matter. And of course, they can also be predicted in string theory that helps to some sort of more in terms of the compactification, things like that. But I'm not really the expert in string theory, so I cannot talk more about that. Okay, so what super radiance does is that it leads to a so-called a phenomenological gravitational atom, or we call it an atom because like once the super radiance happens, it actually forms a hydrogen-like cloud structure around the spinning black hole. And when there's like a formation of such cloud, and it will extract the black hole's energy and momentum, and it will spin down the black hole. And the cloud states will actually have a very analogous set of quantum numbers. So it's really, you know, pretty much like the hydrogen in electron orbitals. So we can use a set of quantum numbers to characterize the cloud states. And the criteria for super radiance to happen is that the boson's angular frequency has to be slower than the multiples of the the black hole's initial angular velocity at the horizon. So the little m here is not the mass of the black hole, but it's the asymptotical quantum number of the cloud state. So we can also characterize the effectiveness of super radiance by a so-called coupling constant, which is really the ratio between the black hole radius versus the wavelength of the particle. And it's a constant if you just look at a single black hole cloud system. But of course, it's not really a constant because we know that there can be various mass of the black holes, right? So strictly speaking, it's only a constant for one particular system. And yeah, so there are already some existing constraints because as I said, there are lots of particle experiments to search for these things using the axion photon coupling. And I'm not going through this plot in detail, but what I want to highlight is that using the black hole spin method or super radiance phenomena, we can actually probe a much lighter mass range that the particle experiments or the other electromagnetic surveys cannot really achieve. So we are talking about for very heavy black hole, like supermassive black hole, we can go down to 10 to minus 20 eV. And then if we are using the stellar mass, the black hole that we can observe in LIGO and Virgo and Kagura, then we can probe at the heavier end is about 10 to minus 12 or 10 to minus 11 eV. And this is really coming from the coupling constant scaling relation, so which is proportional to both the boson mass and also the black hole mass. And so usually alpha G, if that is around 0.1, then we will have a significant super radiance phenomenon. And then that will be observable in gravitational wave searches. Okay. So, and of course, this kind of gravitational atom is like a celestial system, right? So it's a classical system. So it's not like when you have an an actual hydrogen atom, and then there would be, by default, there will be an electron cloud and also a nucleus. So what happens is that once a highly spinning black hole is formed, so it takes time for the cloud to actually form around the black hole, and we can characterize the growth of the cloud by an evolving time scale, which I just calls the scaling here, which is inverse of the coupling constant. And so now, so in a very naive picture, so you can think of the coupling constant that gives rise to effective potential. And if that's smaller, that means the effective potential is weaker and it's harder to form a cloud. So clouds of the higher modes will also grow slower. And that means, like, for example, when we have 30 solar mass black holes that we frequently observed in LIGO, and let's say we have a boson mass that's about 10 to mass 12 eV, so the evolving time scale can grow from within a year up to like mega year at the third mode. And of course, we know that our universe has a very finite time, very finite age. So we don't expect a black hole to exceed the 14 decay year, which is the age of the universe. So it's important to compare the super radiant time scale with the black hole's finite lifetime. And also, it takes about 180 evoldings to actually finish the cloud formation in order to extract all the possible and angular momentum from the black holes to spin it down. So this is important to take into account when we compare to the actual observations. So the effect of super radiance on the binary black hole is the following. As I mentioned, I would just look at the spin down effect. So here is the illustration. So on the right, so we have a binary black hole. Let's say initially we have a black hole is formed at very high spin, which on the left is the parameter space of the black hole mass and spin. And let's say a black hole is initially at the extreme mode. So now given the boson, let's say 10 to mass 12 eV, and then a black hole age, which is about 10 mega year, then we can predict so-called critical spin curve, which says above the curve, super radiance can happen within the age, and then below the curve, super radiance cannot happen within the age of the black hole. So that is to say, as we evolve, it will quickly, the black hole we are considering would quickly spin down to the first mode of super radiance. And then as the system in spiral to each other, it will spin down to the second mode. And because third mode would take 100 mega year to actually spin down, so the final system would just stay in the second mode. So, okay. So let's see. Then you can ask, okay, so now even if we know super radiance can spin down a black hole, but then we don't know from observations that whether apparently small spin of the black hole is really coming from the super radiance spin down or really from the astrophysical process that make the spin at formation is slower, right? So to disentangle these two effects, so we have to look at the signature of super radiance in terms of the population of the black holes. And let's say, again, so here is the probability space of the black hole in terms of the mass and the spin at formation. And for easier visualization, I just sprinkle all the black holes uniformly on this plane. Of course, we know that astrophysically, so the mass is not uniform across spectra, but let's say for visualization, let's say we just sprinkle them uniformly. And as I said, given the boson mass and the age of black hole, we can draw out the critical spin curve. And in the gray area is the black holes can experience super radiance. And and then they will spin down to the critical spin curve once the binary black hole merges, or once when we observe them at a particular age of the black hole. So that is, so we have two signatures in terms of black hole population. So first is, of course, there's a clustering around the critical spin curve, because all this black holes in the gray area was just mapped to the critical spin curve due to super radiance. And another feature is that we are left with the exclusion region in terms of the black hole mass and spin parameter space. So we know there are two features in it. So what would be the search strategy then? So the strategy is, like, of course, we have black hole mass and spin measurements from gravitational waves in a binary black hole. And then we can rule out a boson if one of the black hole is inside this exclusion region, right? Because that just entirely violates the assumption of super radiance. Now, to confirm a boson, that will be trickier, because we need enough events to actually map out the critical spin curve. And that is to make sure we are not confused with the all the spins below any possible distribution that predicts a small spin at the formation. So here is the spin measurement at the merger. So it's so they are different, right? Because the astrophysics can predict something that due to any mass, any wind loss in a binary black hole, or any accretion possible that can spin up the black hole, etc. So those would be some of the messier stellar physics behind that can alter your spin distribution at the formation. So to do this properly, then we use a so-called hierarchical Bayesian framework to combine all the mass and speed measurements. And so this is the standard approach that when we analyze the so-called population of the binary black holes measurements. So then, okay, so the heart of this study is really how do we disentangle the astrophysics that may lead to a small spin at the formation versus whether there can be a super radiance that spins down all the black holes, even if the black holes are born with moderate spins. So, which is rather unfortunately that we don't really know about the origin of the black hole spins in detail. So there are still quite a bit model uncertainties, and you know, in different astrophysical environments, it depends on how the binary black hole is actually formed to give rise to a very large spin or not. So to model the formation spin distribution, so we just use a simple theological model, which has some flexibility to model the shape of the distribution of the black hole spin at formation. So we use a so-called beta distribution, which has two parameters that characterize what's the fraction of the large spin region. So it also recovers this usual distribution, like a uniform or like linear increase, or it can also have a peak structure there. So that is, in our inference, we are actually inferring simultaneously the two effects. So one is the astrophysics, which you can take these two parameters as, you know, some tracer of the astrophysics. And then the third parameter would be, of course, our boson mass that governs whether super radiance can spin, how super radiance would spin down the black holes, which will be the observable during the merger. Okay, so then I'll go to the results. And before we actually go into the boson mass constraints, so let me just refresh some of the memories of what's the status in terms of the speed measurements in GWTC2 or the second catalog of the every K observations. So it turns out that only 6 out of the 45 binary black holes in the second catalog really have precise enough constraints. So by precise enough, it's not really that precise in absolute scale, meaning that if we look at the so-called the spin disk plot, so on the left is the primary black hole, on the right is the secondary black hole. So by primary is the more massive one. So you can still see a very large blob here. So this corresponds to the posterior probability density of the spin magnitude as well as the tilt angles. So that is to say, we are not really good at measuring spins compared to the X-ray binaries method, just because the spin effect is usually hidden in a higher order PN terms in gravitational wave, the waveform of the gravitational wave. So, but it's interestingly, if we just look at these two systems, so 190412 and also 190517, and let's say we do a very poor man approach, so we forget all the statistical details first. So let's just lay out, overlap the uncertainty of the mass and speed measurements on top of the exclusion region of these two particular boson mass. So in particular, the boson mass at 2×10⁻¹³ eV. So we can already see a very large overlap between the speed measurements and also exclusion region. So here, the red and green are the corresponding uncertainty contour of these two particular systems. So I think it's 50 and 95% contour interval. And then we can ask, are these two events enough to set some of the constraints? And the answer is yes. And when we go through the hierarchical Bayesian framework in a more detailed way, then we get the posterior probability measurements of the boson mass. So here is the x-axis is the log scale of the boson mass. So the y-axis is the posterior probability density, again, in the log scale. So the reason I plot in log scale is that I want to highlight the gap here, which is highlighted in the gray area. And I will first focus on your attention on the blue histogram, which is make use of the full catalog. And we see the gap here, and that corresponds to a 0.01 percentage of posterior probability within this tiny range, 1.3 to 2.7×10⁻¹³ eV. So that is to say the data highly disfavor the existence of this this tiny range of the boson. And the reason why I said these two systems are particularly interesting is that when we exclude the two events and we run the analysis, the gap disappears. So it's really these two events that has precise enough and also large spin measurements that give rise to this tiny constraints that we have. And if you have a sharper eye, then you know you may notice a small peak here around 10⁻¹² eV, and then you may wonder, well, if it's real or not. But again, to claim a detection, we have to be very careful, right? Because again, any astrophysically small spin distribution can fool ourselves. So to do this more properly, we rerun the analysis for the spin model without super radiance. That is, for the three parameters model, we turn off the super radiance, the boson mass. That is, we ignore any super radiance spin down effect. And then we can now compare two models with base factor calculation. And it turns out that this peak is just in favor of the boson super radiance model, just by a base vector with 10, which is, you know, which is 10 times less than the usual criteria. So that's to say, well, this peak may really just be some Poisson fluctuation, things like that. And or even worse, may, as we know, the spin, the actual physical spin model is not that realistic. So we, in the paper, we don't claim that as a detection. But the constraints is probably real because, as I said, once you have one particular good precise measurements for high spin, then you know it directly violates the super radiance assumption. So it's not. So it's more like it's always easier to, and it's always cleaner to reject any existence of the boson using the spin measurement. Okay, yeah. So a little bit forecast. Yes.
So if your boson mass is not, let's assume it exists, but it's not in this range you are searching for, what do you expect for this distribution that if you run this hierarchical analysis, what do you expect?
Oh yeah, if there's like no boson in this range, so then we should expect, it should look like a more a real shape. So it should look like it's still a flat distribution. But when we come in that case, we have to compare the base factor with the model that is only containing with the astrophysical spin model only, or we can actually extend the prior range such that you know we include a lighter boson range or a higher boson range that does not. That's not gives rise to any observational signatures in the LIGO band, but we still include a broader prior range, but then we should see like, I don't have a pen, so, so we should see like something like a trough here. So I'm not sure if I can describe this.
Okay, yeah, the reason I want to ask this question is maybe it's outside this range, but right now you're normalizing all your probability within this range.
Yeah.
Right? So you assume you're actually assuming it's in this range, and then probability, the cumulative probability is one. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. But, so I probably don't have the backup slide here. But we also characterize the gap with the base vector approach that we use, and we have a very high base vector in that sense. So I don't have the exact number, but yeah. So there are two ways. Like one is you relax the normalization and then we just say we search for a broader range. And then the second approach is like we do a model compression in a Bayesian sense to see whether it's astrophysical or it is if it is astrophysical plus boson. So yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Can I also add something? So for this like gray region where you're excluding the axion mass, very strongly at this like 10^-4 p value. That's because like for these two events, the spins were excluded from being like very small at the same 10^-4 level.
Yes.
Is that how I should interpret this?
It's kind of, but not exactly, because at the end, super radiance actually gives rise mass and spin correlation, right? So in this plot, you can see that once you turn on the super radiance, so it also tells you that there would be some particular mass correlation with the spins. So I guess besides the precise measurement, so it's kind of, we are lucky that we have two systems that has a very high spin within a certain narrow mass range. So I would put it like that, yeah.
But your green contours seem consistent with zero spin at the two signal level.
It still have a very small fraction outside. So
Right. Okay. So it's like, so your 10 to the minus four P value, I guess, comes entirely from this red contours then?
So not exactly. I don't have the actual curve here. So I think, so here, so if we look at the curve, the purple curve, so that is rejecting this, that is rejecting the green curve. So even we does not include the green curve here, the gap starts to disappear. So it's not just the red curve, but so the both system contributes to this tiny range.
So how do I understand this then? I mean, like, so your green curve seems consistent at the two sigma level.
Yes.
With zero spin. So therefore I would think that, I'm just missing something, I think. So if it allows zero spin, then I would think that it would allow super radiance to happen. No?
Yes. I mean, this fraction, if I remember, is really a percent level. So percent level, you can think of it as like, like one sigma-ish. So that is to say, so to get the 0.01, which is four sigma, so basically you have to add both, right? So like in this curve, like, so we are two sigma or even just three sigma if I extend the contour a little bit. So for the red curve, like it will touch the critical spin at three sigma, like, and then for the green, it's like maybe in two sigma region. So I guess when they add up, it's about four sigma. I'm not sure if, so I cannot do the actual math in my head, but yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I guess it's more like, so the reason why we get really good constraint there is really, we are lucky that in this mass range. So they are both in the same mass range, right? So we can reject the boson in that is comparable with this particular mass of the black holes, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Oh, actually, one related question for your next slide. So for that bump, where the question mark is, I guess presumably that must be dependent on the priors you assume for your alpha and beta.
Yeah. So we use a generally broad prior for that. But I mean, at the end, the prior of the alpha and beta doesn't really mean anything in terms of astrophysical
right.
formation. Okay. So yeah, that's why we really just leave the discussion as, okay, so don't take this too seriously.
Right, okay. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and that actually leads to some of my future work that I want to extend is to use some of the astrophysical simulation to see if I can model the spin at formation more properly and things like that. But those are another PhD project, so I cannot do that in a great detail within a few months. So, yeah. Okay, so guess related to the question actually, so how do we actually confirm the peak that we saw, even if we just assume a very simple model? It turns out that we really need maybe in the order of 1,000 events to actually stack up enough evidence to confirm a boson. So here is the base factor evolution plot. So again, if that is above zero, so the boson model is more preferred. And so let's just look at the orange band, which is correspond to the 10 to the minus 12 eV that we saw. And it turns out that, well, it depends on the actual physical distribution, but we expect we have to obtain at least 1,000 of events to actually confirm a boson in this mass range. So So it's not entirely impossible in advanced LIGO, but it's definitely possible in the next generation detectors when we have much larger SNR and also much more events as we extend our horizon of the detectors. I guess I'll skip this. Just some of the improvements that I want to do in the future, and we can definitely discuss.
May I ask a question? So this is measuring ultralight boson based on the black hole spin. But even you consider super radiance, I mean, there is some other effect, right?
That I didn't mention.
There is gravitational wave generation or stochastic gravitational wave background. Which way do you think is the best way to constrain ultralight boson?
Well, of course, if we have... So in terms of constraints, so all these methods, they share the same caveat, is that we have to know the initial spin distribution properly, right? Because now we have to, for the stochastic background or the continuous wave emission, so you're saying that, okay, if we see an absence of the direct detections from the cloud emission, then we can put some constraint on that. But then that relies on what is your assumption for the initial spin distribution, so you can do some targeted search. Let's say we have X-ray binaries that the well-known system will be Sinus X1, and that has a very rapid spin. I think it's 0.99 something also, or 0.95. And then once you know the spin of that black hole and you see an absence of the cloud emission, then you can constrain a boson very confidently. So I guess the targeted search may be the best one for the stochastic background. So for stochastic background, that is the background of the, so that is sum up all the potential continuous wave from the emission, then we don't know the spin distribution, right? So then so the absence of the background cannot really guarantee constraints. And then with my method, so we are kind of in between these two methods, in the sense that once we saw a highly spinning black hole within a good enough mass uncertainty, then we can also directly impose some constraints. So if I would have to rank, then I would say like the targeted search with continuous wave, maybe slightly larger, slightly better than my method, and then the stochastic method maybe worse in terms of the assumptions.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
May I also ask a question? Like, do you have a plot in terms of like axial mass and coupling? And also, do you have like similar plots for dark photon?
That's a good question. So I guess the second question is that for dark photon, it's a spin one particle, right? So in my search, I only do a spin zero particle, which is a scalar particle. It's because once we have higher spin particles, the super radiance will extract the angular momentum much more efficiently. So the critical spin curve here would be much lower. So this will enclose a much larger area. So, I mean, we can repeat with the higher spin, but at least we think that it would be much harder to do a scalar boson. So that's why we just focus on the scalar boson. And the first question is the coupling, right?
Self interactions.
Yeah, self interactions. Yeah. So in our model, we assume that it's we have negligible self interaction first. And that is to say, if we translate this in terms of another dimension, in terms of self-coupling, we can still reject the QCD axiom, which has a very large, very large coupling? No, very small self-coupling in that sense. Yeah.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah. But there's another thing that I want to extend is like, once we have the self-interaction, then maybe these two systems would be still consistent with the assumption that there's a boson, but it's just the self-interaction term is very large, that the super radiance is not that efficient. Yeah.
Yeah, if I get to ask one more question as well before you move on to the next section. Yeah. So for the age of the black holes that you're assuming here to get this curve, is that like a short enough age that would be kind of applicable no matter what the formation channel is, whether it's like a dynamical formation or formed in the field or something, or is that just kind of assuming vanilla forming in the field?
Yeah, we are assuming a lower bound that is typically 10 mega year from the simulation in both the dynamical channel and isolated channel. Now, of course, there would be some very subtle fraction that, okay, what if like the system is in a dynamical formation channel, which has a very large initial eccentricity, right? Well, in that case, when we have a large eccentricity, then the in-spiral time will be much shorter. And then you know, we may actually overestimate age. But so there are two, I guess, number of estimates that saves our constraint. So first is that to form a very highly eccentric binaries, so the fraction will be very small comparing to the dynamical channels that form the usual circular binaries. So the fraction is perhaps, I think it's a percent level. And then the second thing is that so we also repeat the analysis with two orders magnitude younger age. So we are assuming 10 mega year, but then we also repeat with, I think, 10 to 5 years. So that is 100 kilo year. Yeah, so the 100 kilo year, the constraint is smaller. I don't remember exactly the number because it's in the paper, but we can still reject a tinier range around 10 to minus, around 2 times 10 to minus 13 eV.
Yeah, yeah, thanks.
Okay, any more questions? No. Okay, so I guess I have like around 10 minutes left. So I guess I can briefly go through what I've been doing for primordial binary black holes. So the reason that it would be these kind of primordial black holes are interesting in gravitational emission is that in terms of the formation scenarios and some of the observational scenarios, they are quite different. So I'm not going through the detailed list. So I guess really the main difference is that primordial black holes are formed much in a much earlier universe than any epoch for the first stars. So we are talking about their formation at much even earlier than the CMB epoch in a standard scenario. And then for actual physical black holes, of course, we need some stars to form first, and then we have collapse from the stars or even repeated mergers in order to observe them. So usually the ratio is below 30 or so. So in terms of the binaries, then of course, the binary time scale would be much longer. So the primordial binary black holes would not be like dominated in a redshift much larger than 1,000. So it takes, you know, typically mega year to inspire into each other. But still, the primordial black holes, primordial binary black holes formation history, the merger history is very different from the stellar of the actual physical merger history. So here are some examples. So for the blue, orange, and green, they are from different channels, or let's say in a cluster, or in a galactic field, or even in a very metal-free environment that is the first generation of the stars. So we usually expect them to have a peak structure in terms of merger rates, density. But then for primordial black holes, binaries, of course, they they have been formed in the early universe directly, and then they will just keep merging to each other until there are like some stars to form. So we expect actually the merger race density increases with the redshift. So this is the very distinctive features in terms of the observational scenarios. And I have to mention that advanced LIGO or even like A plus, so we can only detect a very local universe comparing to this redshift range in terms of primordial black holes formation history. So, you know, so that is to say, it's really hard to use the current detections to put any robust constraints because within these regions, so there are lots of astrophysical uncertainties or in other words, they will form a very noisy background in order to really pin down any primordial black hole binaries there. So I guess I'm not going through all the caveats and constraints right now, but the highlight is that even if we even if we consider all the binary black holes in GWTC2 to be primordial, we can put some upper limits in terms of their fraction as a dark matter. But of course, if we want to be more robust, then we need to consider all the uncertain astrophysical foregrounds in terms of the binary black hole mass and spin spectra, because the redshift information right now are not very useful because, you know, because of volume effects, all the merger rate is increasing. It's really hard to disentangle where the redshift evolution just follows the primordial evolution or not, because we still cannot see the peak. And then it's like natural to say, okay, why do we bother the local universe, right? Because we know that primordial black holes, they're primordial. So, you know, it would be much easier to put constraints using the higher redshift observations. Now, of course, we cannot do this right now, and we need the next generation detectors, such as the Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope, which can extend the horizon up to redshift 100 or so, depending on which mass you're talking about. And here's just some brief introduction of these next generation detectors. So the Cosmic Explorer is the 40 by 40 kilometers in the US, and then the Einstein Telescope is a 10 kilometers triangular shape underground facilities in Europe. So they, if the funding progress is smooth, then we expect them to be online like in the 2030s or 2040s. So here's just some prospects, so I'll skip that. So then we need to characterize what would be the high redshift binary black hole measurements in the redshift or in the distance, because we want to know, we want to use the Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope to detect the primordial binary black holes at redshift larger than 30 and then get the Nobel Prize. Right? Of course, life is not so easy because the signal to noise ratios decrease with the redshifts, and we need to quantify how good or bad the redshift measurements can be at such large redshifts, right? And then we also need to be more robust in the sense that we need to consider possible contamination from the population-free binary black holes that is originated from the first stars. Then the first question we can ask is that will we have golden binary black hole detections at this redshift in order to claim the existence of the primordial black holes just using one particular observation. And then to do this, so we first just look at the likelihood, that is we assume a uniform merger race density first. And turns out that the optimal system would be like would be the total mass between 20 and 40 solar mass in the source frame. So here is the x-axis is the true total mass in the source frame, and y-axis is the redshift, and the foulings correspond to the posterior probability density that is expected in the future detectors with a network that is two cosmic explorers. So CS means a cosmic explorer at the south hemisphere. So should be in Australia or something like that. But that is not the full cosmic explorer. So there are some difference. But anyway, so with a free, with a network of next generation detectors, so we can actually measure the high redshift kind of well, in a sense that for the best system here, so let's say the true redshift is 40, and then we can still constrain the redshift at least by 25 or so for the optimal total mass that is between 20 and 40 solar mass, which is nice because we expect the first generation black holes will not be formed below redshift 30 or so. And then that is to say we have a large probability to claim a single detection that is from a much larger redshift, and then that would be a good evidence for the existence for the primordial black holes. And I'm not going through the details on how we quantify more in details the single detection, but at the end, we can always look at the population, right? Because once we have these next generation detectors online, we can measure at least hundreds of these high redshift binaries. And then we can do similar things at the race and population group in the LVK collaboration, that is to map out the redshift evolution with the observations. And then we do a similar things with the mock-up data, and then we use the there can be two approaches. One is to use a phenomenological models for the population-free binary black holes. And the good thing about the phenomenological model is that it turns out that the primordial black holes binary rate is theoretically universal, just because it's, when you think about the theoretical work in terms of modeling the early universe versus the stellar physics, turns out that it's kind of like more under control in modeling the early universe, although they are subject to different initial conditions. But it turns out that this power law here in the primordial black hole merger race density is more or less unaffected by the initial condition, which is nice. Of course, if you are like more like observer, and then you say, okay, I don't believe into any models, I just want to best characterize the evolution, we can use some of the model agnostic approach, that is to use a Gaussian process regression to map out the merger race density. And here are some preliminary results that I haven't really write up in this month, because there are some subtleties that are in this project. But now on the left is the results from the phenomenological model, and we can map our tail pretty precisely. And of course, when we use a model agnostic approach, we can still map out the tail, but not as precise as the phenomenological model, because of course, like when we don't assume a model, then we are less restrictive in terms of the function space, if you think about that. And then, but the punchline is that we can measure the fraction of the primordial black hole as a dark matter fraction as done as low as 10 to the minus 4. And then that would provide a very promising constraint or measurements. And then there would be a lot of implications to the early universe, especially the inflation scenarios. So I guess this is what I have for today's talk. And any questions for this section?
Excellent. Thanks again. We already have quite a number of questions, right? But
yeah,
are there any more?
Yeah, maybe I can ask one about this. Mm-hmm. How certain is this red shape distribution of primordial black hole merger, right? Like, as far as I can tell, people didn't take into account, let's say, clustering effect or like this tidal contribution from, I don't know, dark matter and other things when they compute the merger rate. I mean, like, do you expect this thing to change a lot?
Yeah, this is a bit uncertain. Yeah, it's true that, so in terms of the clustering, I think it will affect the more later time in terms of merger rates. By later time, maybe like in this redshift being 10 to 20 or so. I think there's a paper from Sebastian Pesce. I forgot the author list, but yeah, there's some discussion about the clustering. And because once you have a clustering, and then you can think of that as like more dynamically formed scenario, and then, you know, the time scale would usually be much longer than the standard random pairing scenario. But I think some expectation is that there may be some more perturbation in the smaller redshift region. I cannot guarantee that because I'm not the expert in terms of modeling these primordial black holes. And then the second thing is the tidal effects with the dark matter. That I think is more understood as long as, so the prediction here is confirmed with some of my colleagues in this paper. I don't have the names, but yeah. In the sense that they do some of the N-body simulations with dark matter, and then they still see the universal law. So this law is not affected by much in terms of the tidal effect. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, yeah, so is this published? I mean,
yeah, I think so. I can send you the references later. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
So I don't understand actually how you can make any prediction for this primordial black hole formation rate, right? You know, because that'll depend on the process by which these primordial black holes are forming. Right. So presumably, I guess you're forming them just because like the small scale, you know, curvature power spectrum has some enormous excess on some very small scale. But the clustering of these black holes that form will then also depend on that same small scale power spectrum. And so you have to, you know, specify the shape of the small scale power spectrum, you know, to figure out how much they are spatially clustering. And the clustering entirely determines, you know, the rate at which they are merging, right?
That's true, yeah. Right. I guess the clustering is the more uncertain things that people are still looking into.
That entirely determines this merger rate, right?
Yeah,
you know, because that determines the distribution of their separations.
Yeah, that's true. So once we consider clustering, then yeah, the story will be very different. But I would guess it will affect the shape by quite a bit, but still, like, we don't expect them to be like that all the primordial binaries will appear in a much later time, right? So we still expect there will be a large fraction in the high redshift. It's just how the shape.
So how do you know that, right? I mean,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, so
it depends on the shape of the power spectrum.
So it's really some of the physical guess there. But I guess like at the end, we really need more detailed simulations to confirm that. Yeah, and yeah, of course, like in the worst scenarios, in the sense that they're like the fluctuation is really not that favoring the high redshift formation, then, you know, then we are pretty much screwed and we cannot use this method to put any constraints. But we can still put a constraint that the overdensity does not allow such power law to happen. So we can still say that. So, yeah. That is to say, we can still reject some of the initial conditions. If we
Okay, yeah, I understand. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, any more questions or thoughts? Well, okay, if not, then I guess let's thank Ken again for a wonderful talk.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.